Time to go to Crimes NZ, our weekly look at a high-profile New Zealand crime. Today we look at the Rainbow Warrior sinking in Auckland nearly 35 years ago to the day. It's an event often referred to as the first act of terrorism in New Zealand. Two French agents planted two explosives on the ship while it was berthed at Marsden Wharf, and the second explosion killed Greenpeace photographer Fernando Pereira. To help us navigate through this pretty complex web of deceit by France and find out why they targeted the ship, I'm joined by David Robey, who's currently an AUT Professor of Journalism and Communication Studies, and he's director of the campus's Pacific Media Centre. He's also author of a book called Eyes of Fire, about the last voyage of the Rainbow Warrior. David, hi.
Hi, kia ora. Great to see be here, Jeremy. Thanks.
Yeah, thank you. Hey, welcome to the show. And can we start with your connection to the Rainbow Warrior? So you sailed with the crew on what turned out to be their last voyage.
Well, it was that the last voyage of the original Rainbow Warrior. Of course, the two others followed, Jesse. But the reason why I was on board, because I wasn't actually a member of Greenpeace or anything like that, although I've been an environmental journalist for many years. And at the time, I was very involved in reporting environmental issues around the Pacific. And in those days, Greenpeace was very small. I mean, it was a very fledgling organisation. They had a little office in Nagel House downtown Auckland, and Elaine Shaw was the coordinator. And she was very worried that this was going to be quite a threshold voyage. It was probably the first a campaign by Greenpeace that was humanitarian, as not only environmental, to rescue basically people who had been suffering from nuclear radiation on Rongelap Atoll in the Marshall Islands. And this had been planned for many months, in fact, a couple of years or so. And Elaine was very keen to get some coverage in the media in the Southern Hemisphere. And there were about six journalists that went on board, but I ended up being the only one from the Southern Hemisphere. It was a big commitment at the time because I was a freelance journalist, and it meant joining the Rainbow Warrior in Hawaii and being on board for 10 to 11 weeks, right up until the time of the bombing.
Can you describe the ship?
Well, it was quite different from the sort of ultra-modern environmental ship they have now, is Greenpeace 3. It was an old fishing trawler, about 47 metres or so. The original name was Sir William Hardy. And it was built in Scotland and Aberdeen. And after a life as a fishing trawler, it became a research ship. And then it was sort of up on the market. And David McTaggart, who was then head of Greenpeace, bought it for about £40,000, and it was refitted over in the UK. But before this voyage that I joined, well, of course, it had been refitted in Jacksonville in the US as a combined motor-driven a ship and a sailing ship. So it was quite innovative at the time.
Comfortable to stay on?
Well, I mean, I found it, to be on board for all that time, I actually really enjoyed it. And it certainly was, compared with the comforts today in Greenpeace, on Rainbow Warrior 3, it was pretty rough, but no, it was a lot of character, and it was a lovely ship in many respects, and I guess all of us on board grew to love it incredibly.
It was the US government testing around the Marshall Islands, 67 nuclear tests on several small islands, several atolls, but then, of course, the French were doing similar sorts of testing, and were they the next target for Greenpeace?
Yes, well, this was supposed to be like a combined mission. First of all, rescue the people in Rongelap, and then carry on the next stage of the campaign, going to Mororoa and taking on the French with the nuclear testing there. Of course, the French, over a period of time until they actually sort of stopped testing in 1996, they carried out about 193 tests in the Pacific, and 43 of those were atmospheric. So for our part of the world, probably it was even a greater affront to the region. I wasn't actually planning to go on board that next stage. I mean, once, because I'm a freelancer, earn a biscuit. Mm-hmm. So I planned to sort of leave the ship in Auckland anyway when we arrived back.
So it was stopping off in Auckland on the way to Mururoa.
That's right. That's right. And refitting and preparing for that next stage of the protest.
And to set the scene, younger listeners might not realise that there was already a bit of tension between New Zealand and France in the early 80s. This is our Prime Minister at the time, David Longy, talking about France using the South Pacific, our backyard, to test their weapons.
There are really three questions. Will the French persist in a nuclear testing program? Secondly, if they do, will they do it near us and keep the united opposition of the Pacific against them? Or will they go and do it in their own backyard? Now, I don't want them to test at all. If they must, I don't want them in the Pacific. From the report from Mururoa, there are geological structures in France which have the strength or greater than the strength of Mururoa. It is not a question of geological structure. It is a question of arrogance. It is a question of national pride. And it is simply a whole philosophy built up where they have chosen for donkey's years to inflict their weapons testing on other people for their defence. And that's unacceptable. But I think we need now to go over to Europe and in France, start to say something to the socialists who made the promises before election and back down on them afterwards, and tell them what we think of that. Point out to the French people that they can now look forward to having these tests, which they say are so vital, in their own home, and then we'll see whether they think the whole deterrent program for France is so vital.
Actually, the way he's talking there, I wonder if he was still leader of the opposition. 1984, that would have been long. I don't know if it was pre or post-election, but anyway.
Well, the word I pick up there is arrogance. And, I mean, that's been the history right through for all those years that the nuclear testing was carried on. We have to remember that France got kicked out of nuclear testing in the Sahara Desert prior to the Pacific. With the War of Independence in Algeria, it became untenable for France to carry on its nuclear test. I think they carried out about 17 there in the desert. So they had to hunt around for another place. There was never any debate, serious debate or anything like that, about or any question if it would be in its own backyard, even as David Longy had said at the time, you know, that geologically there's no reason why not. No, politically it was very expedient to have it as far away as possible from France. By and large, in the debate in France, it was always seen as part of the force to throw up the nuclear deterrent that France needed as an independent weapon sort of thing.
So take us then the following year to July 10th, 1985. What happened that night?
Well, that was the bombing on board the Rainbow Warrior and caught the country totally in shock, and also the crew of the Rainbow Warrior and Greenpeace generally. And initially, it was sort of the big questions were asked, well, who could have been responsible for this atrocious, outrageous attack on a peaceful environmental ship sitting here in Auckland?
Can you just take us to the night, by the way? Because I think there was a birthday party or something.
That's right. Steve Sawyer. Basically, you had Peter Wilcox was the skipper on board. And with Greenpeace campaigns, they always had a campaign coordinator as well, who basically organised all their strategies and so on, collectively, of course. So Steve Sawyer was the campaign coordinator for the Marshall Islands and then also going on to Mururoa. So it was his birthday that night. That was 3 nights or 3 days after we arrived back in Auckland. So that's when the attack happened. And I think it's an incredible miracle that only one person lost his life, Fernando Barrera, as you mentioned earlier on in the introduction.
So you were at the party?
I wasn't there that night because I had already been on board 10 and a half weeks. And I was very keen to sort of be on shore for a while. So I was home that night. I tried to organise a scout trip for my 8-year-old son and 4-year-old earlier on that evening, and that never eventuated, but it was probably a good thing anyway that hadn't happened. But no, so I wasn't there actually on board. I joined the crew early in the morning when I heard what had happened.
So there were a few on board when the first explosion took place?
Oh, yeah, yeah. Everybody scurried to try and get off, including Fernando, because Fernando went back on board to grab his camera and gear and so on. And I just think it's staggering. I mean, because a lot of the media coverage at the time focused on, well, as the story unveiled further on down the track, you know, the idea was that, well, it was never meant to be any loss of life. It was an outrageous act of terrorism. The bombers knew very well, because they were getting information all the time, that there was a large crowd on board the Rainbow Barrier that night. The chances were very high that there could have been a loss of life. I think it's quite extraordinary that, for example, Bunny and Hanker, two of their crew members, were in a cabin immediately above the engine room where the first bomb went off. The second was close to the propeller shaft to make sure that that the ship would never really sail again, sort of thing.
Where is Marston Wharf?
Oh, just down here off Auckland, right in the harbour there.
So a real central city.
Yeah, right in the
Bardock, yeah.
Yeah, exactly. Further over from there. I had a cabin on board down below, just near Fernando's cabin. And it's a very narrow stairway down to the aft cabins. I had the opportunity of going back on board the Rainbow Warrior some weeks later when it was refloated, taken over to Devonport Naval Base. Mm. So I was able to see all the damage that had been created. And I was quite staggered. My own cabin, you know, the entire floor had sort of erupted and bunks were wrecked and so on. And Fernando had a cabin just right close to that and presumably got trapped once the second bomb went off and the water would have come down this very narrow, cascaded down through the stairs and caught him there.
Let's go to the morning after the bombing then, and this is how it was covered here on RNZ on Morning Report.
Explosions rang out from the 40-metre ship at about midnight, and the crew scrambled to get off the vessel to safety as she began going under. But one crew member was caught below decks, and police recovered his body early this morning. Stunned Greenpeace members say the vessel was priceless, but right now they're still mourning for their dead colleague who went down with the vessel.
All we know is that between the first and second explosions, he went back aboard, presumably to retrieve his camera gear, and he never made it out.
Rainbow Warrior didn't go to a warrior's death. She sank in her sleep just after midnight, tied up at an Auckland wharf. It's a tragic end to what was probably the world's number one peace vessel, small as she was. What blew her up and killed a man of peace?
Say half of the world leaders of Greenpeace are in New Zealand at the moment.
So the one big question mark in your mind at the moment is?
Is what happened on the boat last night? Was it an accident or was it not an accident?
We know now, of course, that it wasn't an accident. I'm talking to David Robey with memories of 1985 when the Rainbow Warrior, the Greenpeace ship, was bombed here in New Zealand. We later found out a lot about how it was done. What did we find out about how the French planned and executed this mission?
Well, basically, it's a campaign called Operation Satanique. It was basically 13 secret operatives, agents, were operating from the DGSE in the country at the time. Two teams, one that brought the explosives, the other one that was going to plant the explosives, and there was a third team, fail-safe in case anything went wrong with the first two teams. Then there was a commanding officer who kept an overview of the whole operation. I think there was an element of arrogance. It's the same as the arrogance about the nuclear testing itself. There was extraordinary arrogance about, taking on an operation like this in a peaceful country. Mm. We were certainly an ally of France at the time, you know, and basically assuming that they could get away with this outrageous act.
And eventually... Well, how many agents were involved in total?
About 13 in three spread over the three groups.
And two were caught.
Two were caught. With a little bit more luck, they might have actually got more. But you have to sort of see it in the context of the period, of the time. The whole, you know, New Zealand was unpopular with the major nuclear powers and so on. And there was certainly no sympathy for New Zealand's position about nuclear testing. So there wasn't really any kind of cooperation, even from Labour Australia. Because had we had more cooperation from Australian authorities and so on, we probably would have got agents that were on board the Uvea, the yacht that carried explosives, and they were in Norfolk Island. But it was extraordinary that we got two anyway. Mafar and Pier, that were the two that were caught.
Yeah, that might answer the question that Greg's got on text about why we weren't warned about the bombing, why we didn't get any message or clue that it was going to happen.
Well, I think that's, personally, that's something I've really wondered about for all those years, you know, with our so-called close liaisons that we have, intelligence, and now, of course, New Zealand being part of Five Eyes and that sort of thing. We did not benefit in any way from intelligence because, really, the police were operating from the base of never an experience with terrorism of this scale, certainly state terrorism. I'm sure the SAS and our intelligence networks and so on had a lot more information, and that certain amount leaked out at the time that they had more information than probably the police could possibly have at that time. So I think we're very much let down by our intelligence community.
Let's go to the arrest then of Dominic Prieur and Elaine Mafar. Here's Ray Wilmot from what was known at the time as 1ZB.
A quite incredible scene at the back of the High Court in Auckland as a senior police officer cleared a path and a small convoy of two police cars and the enclosed prisoner's truck swept into the driveway at quite high speed. TV crews, reporters and photographers flung themselves into their pre-selected vantage points up trees and over walls as the police slammed the iron gate shut behind the convoy. The cameras poked into the small yard, and amid cries of, "I was here first," photographers threw themselves to the ground to try and poke their lenses under the gates to see if they could get shots of the French couple arriving. I don't think they were successful.
So any contrition from the French government?
Well, it took a long time, you know, and of course they had to pay compensation with a lot of strong negotiation that went on for both New Zealand government and also Greenpeace. But justice was never really served. With the case, for example, that originally both Mafar and Prieur were charged with murder and arson and so on. And then with the extraordinary scenes that we've just heard at court, basically they pleaded guilty to the lesser charge of manslaughter. And, of course, they were sentenced to 10 years and 7 years for the damage to the Greenpeace itself. But this is where this is a terrible result of this lack of justice in a sense that the 10 years were never served. Both Mafar and Prieur was part of the negotiations that went on, but with the French government, basically France had New Zealand over a barrel over trade and the European Union and so on. And so compromises were done. And so eventually Mafar and Prieur were handed over to France for 3 years, essentially house arrest. On how Atoll, which was the rear base of the French nuclear operations in Polynesia. And many would describe it as...
So France sends 13 agents to New Zealand to commit an act of terrorism on New Zealand soil. We catch two of the 13, sentence them to 10 years in jail, and then France blackmails us with trade as a bargaining
exactly
chip.
Exactly, blackmail.
In order to get these agents back to France,
and so
where they spent 3 years on an island.
Well, they didn't even spend 3 years there. I mean, anybody would describe it as like a military club med. Mm-hmm. But they didn't spend 3 years there. Their excuses found, for example, Mafar, they created a false identity and smuggled them out of Tahiti Tahiti back to France. And Pierre became pregnant and she went back to France. So, well, within their three-year period they were supposed to serve. And then, of course, they both wrote books, you know, as lauding their achievements, so-called achievements, you know. It's outrageous, really.
Here's Greenpeace Captain Peter Wilcox describing how it feels even now, many years later, about the French government's response to their protest. And he sums it up pretty succinctly, probably, how many people felt about the revelation. This is him talking to TVNZ's Sunday program in 2016.
So completely shocked. I mean, how could we, a bunch of hippies on an old steel trawler, scare a superpower so much they would set out to murder us? What possibly could we have done? We were speaking truth to power. That was about it. Is that really what scared them so badly?
Do you remember how you felt at the time?
Angry, upset, and deeply shocked, actually. I'm, as a journalist working in the Pacific, I put it in the context of what was already happening in the Pacific, where France during the 80s had been responsible for repression in New Caledonia, French Polynesia, Tahiti, and there'd been assassinations by military forces and so on of independence leaders like Ilo Machero and so on. So when you put it all in the wider context of geopolitics and France's interests in the region, you start to understand. Because if you just look at the Rainbow Warrior alone, you think, how crazy? How could a nation do that? You know, against one of its friends. But when you see it, you know, it was a part of a pattern at the time.
Jean-Luc Cister was the name of one of the agents who actually planted the bomb. And he did an interview also with TVNZ's Sunday program about their mission. And he talks in this clip about it was how it was never their intention to harm anybody. Have a listen to this.
We were not cold-blooded killers. We did everything to preserve the life of the people on board of the Rainbow Warrior.
Do you believe that?
No, I don't believe it for a moment. No, I have to say, I lived in France for many years, and I love France, and I worked for a French news agency and so on. But it's a wonderful country, but in terms of politics in the South Pacific and how it treated New Zealand at that time were just simply abhorrent. I think it was quite extraordinary, though, that that statement was made by Kister, Colonel. I don't believe that he was saying it for form, really, but it is extraordinary that a military officer of his background and so on would even come out publicly and speak about it. So I guess we can give him a little bit of benefit of the doubt that it must have played on his conscience over the years. I hope it did.
So what's been the long-lasting impact of the bombing here in New Zealand?
Well, I think it was a baptism of fire, a loss of innocence when that happened. And in the context that we had stood up as a small nation on being nuclear free, something we should have been absolutely proud of, which we were, of all those who basically campaigned for that at the time. And I think that that really established our independence, if you like, as a small nation. And I think we have a lot to contribute to the world in terms of peacemaking and so on. And we shouldn't lose track of that. That the courage that was shown by this country standing up to a major nuclear power and all those others that wouldn't actually come out and challenge and question it, we should follow through on that sort of independence of thought. We should be a leader in terms of peace and nuclear-free throughout the world, because we now have a period where during the Cold War period with the United States and the Soviet conflict, we're now replacing that with the US and China. And so once again, there is that growing risk of a nuclear war.
The Rainbow Warrior itself is now off Matauri Bay in Northland. It's a diving attraction. Is that a fitting resting place, do you think?
There's a lot of controversy about the time, but ultimately I see it as very much a contribution to the environment and certainly much better than just a memorial or something like that, you know.
Lovely to have you in. Thanks for sharing your insights. We're going to finish with a clip from a documentary that you made, and it features music composed by a string band in Vanuatu. Do you know the piece?
Yes, great.
Okay, it's called No More Bombs.
Yes. Yeah. Thanks, Jesse.
David Robbie, thanks so much. RNZ National, No More Bombs. And that completes our NZ Crimes segment on the bombing of the Rainbow Warrior.